I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm a real alcoholic. I got my bottle with me. I want to thank the committee for giving me an opportunity to participate in my recovery. I mean, standing up here looking out at you, it is absolutely amazing to me what women in recovery can do. And my hat's off to the committee here who put this together. I want to welcome the newcomers. I was talking with Diane before the meeting a little bit, and is it true that you went out and drank after Kay's talk Thursday night? That's welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is I'm stunned by somebody who can come to something like this with less than 24 hours of sobriety. I have 24 years of sobriety, and I'm a wreck here. So, welcome. We're glad that you're here. Sheila was talking earlier at the dinner table, telling a drugstore story, and it made me start thinking about a drugstore story. A couple years ago, I was hanging out at the drugstore. I like doing that. I kind of hang around the pharmacy and salivate every once in a while, but I was at my local drugstore, and they had a sale on seeds, 10 packs of seeds for a dollar. And I started thinking about my backyard, and I have a slope in the... Well, I used to. I lost custody of the yard, but I used to have a slope in my backyard about as long as this stage, and there was nothing planted on it. And I thought, you know, that would be a nice place for a garden. 10 packs of seeds for a dollar. I think I'll put a garden on that slope. So it took me about 45 minutes to decide what seeds to buy. And after about 45 minutes, I picked my 10 little packs of seeds, and I went home to plant my garden, and I looked at the slope, and I suddenly started thinking, boy, if I plant the seeds in this slope, when I water the slope, the water's going to run down the hill. And how will I know that any of the water actually is going to get to the seeds? So I thought about it. I thought, well, what I need to do is build a retaining wall and fill it in with dirt. Now, I'm not a mason, but I went down to the local hardware store and bought a truckload of brick and some cement and mortar and the appropriate clothing for the job. And I went home and started building my wall. And I don't know about other people, but I kind of ran out of steam at about 3 feet high. It looks like more fun than it really is, but I got it built. It wasn't real straight, but if you put enough stucco on it, you can kind of straighten it out with stucco. And I had some dirt brought in and filled it. Well, when they put the dirt in, it still sloped a little too much, so I had to do a second tier. And I put a second tier wall up and filled it in a little bit more. And then I'm ready to plant my seeds, and I'm looking out there thinking, boy, I'm not home a lot. I mean, I work a lot, and I'm out of town a lot, and I'm gone for weekends a lot, and who's going to take care of who's going to water my seeds? So I decided I needed to run water out there, and I'm not a plumber, but bought the appropriate clothes and tapped into the main water line at my house and ran water out to that little area and got some drip hose to put around because I figured, well, it'll drip. I won't have to worry about flooding. And then I started thinking, well, who's going to turn the water on? And I needed to get some electricity out there so I could put timers on the water. And I'm not an electrician, but I tapped into the electricity and I ran some. Of course, I had the appropriate clothes, but I ran some electricity out to my little area and put in some timers. And while I was at it, I just put Malibu lights in too, so it would look kind of nice. And I got it all done, and it cost me about $2,700 to plant a dollar's worth of seeds. And the reason I share that story with you is because what I suffer from is alcoholism. I don't suffer from alcoholism. I have alcoholism. And it manifests itself differently as I continue to recover, but it continues to manifest itself. And because I have alcoholism is why I'm here with you tonight. Because I have alcoholism, I need to be always in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to be in the middle of you, because I suffer from alcoholism. And Diane, I hope you know that you suffer from alcoholism, and you need to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whenever I have an opportunity, and I'll tell you another thing, if you're going to plant a garden, there is no reason to ever plant more than one zucchini seed. Whenever I have the opportunity to do this, my sponsor always says to me, tell him your name and tell him the truth. I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. And the reason for that, I mean, I don't know what kind of alcoholic you are, but I never knew that what it was like was going to be important. When I was out there, I didn't know that I was going to be expected to report to you. If I would have known when I was out there that I was going to have to report what it used to be like, I can guarantee you I would have taken notes. I would have certainly paid a lot more attention to my life. And if I would have known particularly about steps 4 and 5, I would not have done some of the things that I did. But I didn't know it was going to be important, so I didn't pay a lot of attention to my life. On top of that, I'm a blackout drinker. I love blackouts. Absolutely love blackouts. I don't understand people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous in a panic. I'm absolutely stir crazy because they were in a bar last night, and at 9:20 they ordered a drink, and the next thing they knew it was 10 to 10, and they lost a half an hour, and they panicked, and they came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't understand that. I love blackouts. There was something really exciting for me about leaving work on September 12th, going back to work on September 21st, and realizing I'd been there the entire time. I love that. I wish we could do that sober. It makes the time between paychecks go so much quicker, you know. Zoom, zoom, zoom. I love blackouts. But if you're a blackout drinker, it makes reporting what it used to be like a little bit difficult. I mean, a lot of what I share with you is documented, and I can go back and look it up. A lot of it's been reported to me by other people, and I just have to believe they were telling me the truth. I have a job. I had to get a fingerprint clearance. I'm really, really good at fingerprinting. I fingerprint really, really well. I know just how to roll with it. I mean, I don't resist. I know how to fingerprint, and I had to go get this clearance, and they were fingerprinting me, and I'm rolling right along with the prints, and I didn't want to raise any red flags, so I very casually said to the woman fingerprinting me, I said, how far back are you going to check? And she looked me in the eye, and she said, from the day you were born. And I thought, oh, my God, it's like a fifth step, only it's in the wrong order. Because they're going to know about it before I do. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. So I know a lot more about my story since I got that fingerprint clearance than I knew before. So I'm gonna share with you my perspective of what it used to be like, and I can only hope this is the truth. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 13 years old. I'm sorry I waited that long, but I didn't have any idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I grew up in an alcoholic home, only I didn't know it was alcoholism. I thought my father was weird and my mother was nuts. I didn't know it was alcoholism, and I don't remember ever thinking I would never drink. I don't remember ever thinking I can't wait till I drink. I just don't remember thinking about alcohol one way or another. And yet when I was 13 years old, I was on this camping trip with a group of girls in just south of Oceanside in Southern California on the beach. And I remember that Friday night when we went to got into the tent, I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And I remember being excited about having it. And I don't know where that bottle came from. I believe it was the grace of God, but I can never be sure. And I didn't know what alcohol would do to me or for me, but I remember being excited about having that bottle. And I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting any is all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around the tent, and nothing had gotten different, and nothing had changed, and I drank the second half of the bottle, and that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never got resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous is I heard you talk about your first drink. And you talked about taking the drink, and you felt the warmth in your mouth. And you somehow, it was like magic, and you talked about it like magic, and you talked about how it went down your throat, and you felt it as it went down your throat. And you felt it as it hit your stomach, and it hit your stomach and exploded, went to your fingernails and your toenails, and your pimples fell off, and you grew a few inches, and you lost about 30 pounds, and you became Prince Di, or Princess Di, and wonderful things happened to you. And that wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol, and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me is that I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief tonight that if you were to drink a quart of anything in about 15 minutes, you would have to go to the bathroom. And I got out of the tent, and I shuffled through the sand down to the outhouse there on the beach, and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely and totally 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating. And I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Of course, later in my drinking, I did discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time. If the second person is very careful about what they're doing, but I didn't know that at 13. I somehow, sitting there paralyzed, I somehow knew that the body was made up of energy. And I somehow figured that if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. So I suppose it was my first formal meditation, because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be all in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Of course, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy. I was in the Marines. I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety, and if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. In my own defense, I always have to add that my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I still believe under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either, so I got out of there. And that was my first drink of alcohol, and it was the most wonderful, incredible, marvelous, magnificent, fabulous, spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still have a little problem. I'll tell you, if you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely. And if I start laughing at your neck, just knock me away. I'll be all right. I'm one of those people, I came to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom. I mean, that's... I'm often tempted when I introduce myself to say I'm Patty and I'm a pig. But I don't know that I'm living any different than anybody else. I don't know that my life's any different than anybody else's life. And really, how would I know? I mean, I wasn't talking about it. I became a bar drinker. I was a living room drinker, a bedroom drinker, an alley drinker, a dumpster drinker, an office drinker. I didn't specialize. I just drank. But I love bars. I love really, really sleazy bars. The ones with the sawdust on the floor. I particularly like them if the mirrors are cracked, so you kind of have to dip around back there to see yourself. The upholstery on the bar is ripped where people have tried to hold on as they're falling off. And they're full of that, they're full of smoke, and they have that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still. I love that smell. Sometimes when I'm in a particularly cranky mood, I go by one of those joints. I just open the door and take a big hit off of that stuff, and it just perks me right up. But you know, I'm always fascinated about the quality of people who drank in those bars. I mean, in retrospect, I think about the quality of people. I mean, there were neurosurgeons. There were CEOs of really big companies. There were bank presidents. There were admirals in the Air Force. I mean, that's what they said they were. And I never told a lie in a bar. I mean, but we weren't sitting around those bars having conversations like, well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? What's your preference, Chantilly or Aqua Velva? I mean, we weren't having those kinds of conversations. So it doesn't occur to me my life is any different than anybody else's. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body and from that day on I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink, and I think everybody lives like I do. I don't know that my life's any unusual than anybody else's. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State. I graduated from there with a 3.8 grade point average. A chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I'm drinking on a daily basis, and I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average. And the reason I share that with you is because it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got here, I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. I stayed in San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego. I believed I was leaving because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. I have a disease that manifests itself in justification, rationalization, and denial, only I don't know it. I thought I was leaving San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. It never occurred to me that I was leaving because I had one more drunk driving assault charge pending. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous is I discovered here you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And here's what I do. I'm driving down the street minding my own business. I am not bothering anybody. I'm only trying to get home. And I'm driving down the street, and the light comes on behind me. And I'm a rule follower. I know it means pull over, so I pull over. The officer comes up to the door. As he approaches the car, the first thing I do is slam my car door open. My intent is to knock him in the private parts. Men are a little fussy about their private parts. So as the door is flying open, he jumps back. And when he jumps back, it's really a good thing because now I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me. I think I can take him. One of him, one of me. I think I'll try. And I go out the car for him. And it's a pretty good fight for a couple of minutes. But I never remember that he's got a friend back at the car. And the friend's got a radio. And the friend calls some more friends. And pretty soon it's four or five of them against me. Well, I know it's not fair anymore, so I say, Uncle. And they take me away. The next time the light comes on, I pull over. Officer walks up, I slam the car door open. He jumps back, I get him in focus. I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I go for him. And I don't remember the friend back at the car. And I don't remember the radio, and I don't remember the friend's friends. And pretty soon it's five or six of them, it's one of me, it's not fair anymore. I say, uncle, and they take me away. And the next time the light comes on, and I don't do that once or twice. I do that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. And I never remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friends. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over and over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time it's a fair fight. This time I'm going to take him over and over and over. And I want you to know, when you get out of the car the way I got out of the car, they attach an assault charge. They don't even care that they won the fight. Drunk driving assault. Drunk driving assault. Drunk driving assault. I didn't think I was leaving San Diego because I had another drunk driving assault charge pending. I was, I don't know if it was a good thing or not, but a while ago in California, they didn't get so upset about drunk driving. When I get arrested for drunk driving assault, I call my attorney. I pay him $1,000, which was a lot of money. But I'd pay him $1,000, he'd write a letter, he'd make a phone call, whatever he'd do, and that'd be that. That was the end of it. One time, though, my attorney called me. He was a little nervous because I had two of them pending at the same time. And my attorney was worried about it, and I thought, if my attorney's worried about it, I better worry about it. So I was sitting in the bar worrying about the fact that I had two drunk driving assault charges pending, and I struck up a conversation with this guy sitting at the bar next to me. And as it turned out, he worked in a mortuary, and I came up with a plan. And I think as alcoholics, we come up with really good plans really quickly. We went over to the mortuary, we got a death certificate, we put my name on it, we filled out some information, we forged a doctor's signature, and we sent it to the court. Because the judge can't expect much of you if you're dead. So I called my attorney and I told him he didn't need to worry about it anymore. He didn't worry about it. I didn't worry about it. Nobody worried about it for about a month. And then I got arrested for drunk driving assault. And I'll never forget, the judge wanted to see me that time. It's like, why? He never wanted to see me before. Why does he want to see me now? But I went. And I'll never forget him sitting up there. You know how they sit way up here? Sitting up there looking at me. He said, Miss Ochoa, he said, tell me, how is it a dead person is standing in my court? I shrugged my shoulders. I said, I don't know, bad luck. And that's what I thought it was. It was bad luck. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was you and they and them. It was a lot of stuff. Never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. Absolutely never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. And I had another one, and I thought that's why I was leaving San Diego. I had a roommate who was annoyed with me. I mean, I know we're not supposed to talk about them, but I have to tell you about my roommate. I had a roommate who was so inconsistent. Even as a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, even in the worst of my alcoholism, I had a tremendous amount of compassion. And I would be sitting in the bar drinking. Now, the men who drank in the bars that I drank in had very little creativity. They had two basic lines. My wife doesn't understand. And their other line was, I have no place to stay tonight. Now, I had a tremendous amount of compassion, so one of these guys would come on to me with one of those lines, and I would say, listen, idiot, I'll take you home with me tonight, but I don't want to talk to you again until the bar closes. So the bar would close. Being a woman of my word, I would take this guy home with me. Now, we would get to my house, and I would point to the bedroom over here on the right and tell him to go ahead into the bedroom. I had to go to the bathroom. He'd go into the bedroom on the right. I would go into my bedroom on the left. And I had just sent him in with my roommate. Now, a lot of times that was okay with her. A lot of the times she didn't mind at all. Other times it would upset her, apparently, and within minutes there'd be all this banging at my door, which I'd, of course, locked. I mean, I had 7 o'clock classes. I had to get some sleep. I was banging on my door, and I thought, If it would have always been all right or never been all right, I would have been okay, but she was so inconsistent. I mean, you'd have drank if you lived with her. She was so inconsistent. So I don't think I'm leaving because she's annoyed with me. I truly believe I'm leaving because I've taken all the classes that San Diego State had to offer. I was offered a job in Chico, California, which is as far north as you can get and still be in California. I loaded everything I owned into my car. I took two cases of beer, two bottles of booze, and I headed north. I got about 80 miles north of San Diego to Santa Ana. I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. I pulled off the freeway. I have a sense I can find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in, it was full of smoke, it had that wonderful used booze urine smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. I sat down and ordered a drink, and that's as far north as I ever got. 80 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my lover, my friend, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned. I suppose it was in the middle of my first drink. At some point, though, it had turned and began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, honesty, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. Alcohol controlled every area of my life. It controlled where I would live and where I would work. And I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I didn't have a choice. And Santa Ana is not where you want to shoot for, let me tell you. I got a job in the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top. And that, too, almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous because I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the big oak desk I sat behind. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about was I was in the newspaper business, and because we were a community paper, we often gave awards. And I know tonight it was because God gave me a gift, we often won awards. What I didn't tell you about was the times that I would be behind a podium much like this in a room full of people, and I would come out of a blackout holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down. And somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Junior Women's League, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you about that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous after what I pray God was my last drunk driving assault charge. I had lost my driver's license in the state of California for life. I didn't know driver's license had anything to do with driving a car. I could drive a car fine without one. I had a little difficulty cashing a check, but I really didn't have much of a problem driving. I'm one of those people, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report, I read it, I find out where I made my mistake so that I can practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And you see, I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time. So I practiced field sobriety tests a lot. And on what I pray God was my last drunk driving assault, at the end of the test, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had answered, I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I had just confessed, and they... So on the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around, and I said, Jesus. See, you think it's funny. He didn't even think it was amusing. I was turned around, and he cuffed me, and he took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. And I knew I didn't belong there. I went to court on that charge. I was 26 years old. I went to court drunk. It's the only way I went to court. It's the only way I went to work. It's the only way I went to the laundromat. It's the only way I did anything. I stood in that courtroom that morning at 26 years old, drunk, and because of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. I didn't really like this child. I mean, he got in my way. He interfered with my life. He was quite a disruption. I'm not proud to say this, but my son spent the first 11 months of his life in one of those plastic things that you put children in when you don't want to touch him, sitting on a pool table in a sleazy bar. And I wasn't all that thrilled about being a mother, but I was willing to use him that morning. And I told the judge he couldn't put me in prison because I was a single parent and I was self-supporting through my own contributions. And he told me he would put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother. and he began to sentence me. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on his face changed. The tone of his voice got different, and I know that he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because in the middle of sentencing me, he looked at me and he said, "I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance," and he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meeting some Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish I could tell you that I left the courtroom, I came here, I looked at the 12 steps, I knew they were the solution to the problems of my life, I worked them all in this first week and skyrocketed to recovery. And if Kay wasn't here, I would tell you that story, but but that's not my story. I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you that I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I have never known. I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing, what the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a Sunday night, and it was a speaker meeting, and I can't tell you who talked that night, but I heard two things. I heard, "We don't drink between meetings." I quickly looked around, and I didn't see any of you drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you don't drink between the meetings and you're not drinking in the meeting, when do you drink? This made me really nervous. The other thing I heard was that the answers were in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how irritated I was when I got home. Not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. That's the only reason I came back. I don't think it matters why you come back. I think what's important is that you come back. I don't think it matters what your motive is. I don't think it matters what your intention is. I don't think none of it matters. I think what matters is that you come back. Wednesday was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room and I looked around the room and I looked around the room and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any lengths to get it. Some of you had nice jewelry. If you stood next to me during the Lord's Prayer, if your rings were loose, they were mine. Some of you have nice cars. I have a record for Grand Theft Auto. I know how to get those, but I don't think I'm a thief. My sponsor had to tell me. I think it's really critical you have a sponsor. I think it's really important to have a sponsor who's not as emotionally involved in your life as you are. It irritates me sometimes, but it's really a good thing because my sponsor has a different perspective of my life than I do. You know, she had to tell me I'm a thief. I don't know I'm a thief. And you tell me what you think. I'm in a bar drinking. The bar closes. I find some keys on the bar. I pick them up. I go find the car that they fit, and I'm driving myself home. Now, my sponsor and the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. I mean, I just need to get home. My disease manifests itself in justification, rationalization, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain it to you why I had to do it that way. And as I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. And as I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I just need to get home. I don't understand Grand Theft Auto, but I have a record as a car thief. I know how to get those. We all know how to get. Some of you have nice spouses, and we all know how to get those. We don't keep them well, but we know how to get them. And then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants. I don't know about in Georgia, but in Southern California, the kids wear pants that have, I mean, they're so baggy, they have absolutely no relationship to their body size. I mean, they're, and I work with teenagers, and I'm forever telling these boys that they could put a homeless family in their pants with them. I mean, they're not that baggy, but Dick's pants were baggy, and he had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I quickly figured he was shooting heroin, because folks who shoot heroin nod out. And I have to do this thing and not drink. I can probably do it if I can shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked, and the next day I snuck down to his office, and I said, "Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it." And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, He said, I guarantee you, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my relationships would get better, my family life would get better, my job life would get better, my finances would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. A little hope for the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here tonight, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. You see, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I'm going through something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. And I don't know good from bad for me. I've gone through times in my sobriety where my entire life has fallen apart. I've gone through times sober where I've lost jobs, I've lost relationships, I've lost stuff. I've gone through times sober where I have truly believed that God brought me this far and then took off to 10-to-1 of you and left me. And in those times, I have believed my life was falling apart. And I don't drink and I don't die and I don't drink and I don't die and I don't drink and I don't die. And I get far enough beyond it to, in retrospect, see that every time I have thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. See, I don't let go easy. I mean, everything that has been removed from me has claw marks on it. I don't let go easy. I get comfortable with whatever it is. And I get comfortable and I'm unwilling. And God just sort of has to bring me here or rip it away. My job is to not drink and not die, to move beyond it, to see that there's a God who has a plan for me beyond my wildest imagination, beyond anything I could dream up for myself. And certainly more than anything that I would settle for. God has more for me than I would settle for. But you know what? I believed that old guy that day, and I don't know why I believed him. I was later to find out that he'd been sober longer than I'd been alive. The reason that he nodded out in meetings is he had something inside that I didn't have a clue as to what it was. He had a peace and a rightness and a serenity inside. And I didn't have a clue as to what that was, but I believed him, and I already had the book, so every night I'd open it to chapter 3, and I'd read the line that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. I would go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee on the way out. I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty. That was talking to another alcoholic. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive. But I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail, so I went to the 2 meetings a week that my court program said I had to go to. And the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And for me, it took 8.5 months of not drinking to get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. You all saw it when I came in. But you gave me the dignity to do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it. Until I got far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism, it was piled this high. But my disease won't let me see that I have a disease. I justified, I rationalized, and I denied. I gave you all the reasons why I couldn't be an alcoholic. And you just nodded your head, and you'd tell me to keep coming back. Usually a little blue-haired lady, and I'd flip her off, and I'd wave my court card in her face, and I'd tell her I didn't have a choice. And I was not a wonderful, kind, and loving newcomer. I hit people, I kicked people. I threw coffee pots at meetings. I carried a big knife in my boot. I'd bring it out. I just wanted a reaction. If somebody reacted, I would clean my fingernails. If you didn't react, I threw it at the literature table. I always aimed at the piece of literature a member's eye view. I didn't always hit that, but that's what I aimed for. One night a guy was sharing. He didn't say anything to me. I just took it personally. After the meeting, I jumped him. I was beating his head into the concrete floor. Took 6 guys to get me off of him. I knew when they did, they were going to tell me I couldn't come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was trying to get thrown out. It never occurred to me just to leave. I thought you had to get, thrown out. And I knew they were going to tell me I couldn't come back. And when they got me off of him, one of those men looked at me and he said, Patty, next time that volcano explodes, so just put your hands in your pockets and don't touch another human being. And I wondered how he knew about the volcano. Nobody had ever talked to me about the volcano before, but that's what I had inside of me. I had a volcano inside of me. And when it erupted, I had to do something. When it erupted, I wanted to see blood, preferably yours. When interrupted, I didn't seem to have a choice, and Alex told me to put my hands in my pockets and not touch another human being, and I had to walk around Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time with my hands in my pockets before I discovered that that anger was a cover for a tremendous amount of fear. I was absolutely scared to death. I was afraid of you. I was afraid of me. I was afraid of life. And you can't survive in the places I survived in if you're afraid. And so as a small child, I began to cover that fear with anger and acted out in violence. And by the time I got here, that was all I had, was anger and rage and violence. And Alex told me to put my hands in my pockets and not touch another human being. And I wanted to drink more than I wanted to breathe. And that didn't go away for a long time. And one night I heard the traditions read. I know now they read them at every meeting, but I never heard them. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I leapt out of my chair. I was so excited. I said, that's it, that's it. I don't have a desire to stop drinking. I want to drink more than I want to breathe. I can't stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started to leave, and one of the old-timers grabbed me, and thank God for the old-timers. This guy grabbed me, and he said, Patty, he said, there's a judge in South Orange County Court. He has a desire for you to stop drinking. And in your case, we're going to let that be enough. And I stayed on somebody else's desire. I don't think it matters whose desire you're here on. I think what's important is that you're here and you don't take a drink. I don't think it matters if you're here to get a husband back or to lose a husband. I don't think it matters if you're here to save a job or lose a job. I don't think it matters if you're here because of the court or your mother. I think what's important is that you're here and that I don't take a drink of alcohol. For me, that was what was important. And for me, it took 8.5 months before I got far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. 8.5 months sober, I took the first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. That whenever I drink alcohol, I'm damned to live the same way day after day, and I have no choices. When I ingest alcohol, I have to live that way over and over and over. I sit on bar stools and I dream dreams. I plan plans. I have a vision. I have a mission statement for my life. But all I can do is order another drink and order another drink and order another drink, and I can't get it done. Alcohol controls my life. When I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. Whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. Whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose. And that's the powerlessness and that's the unmanageability. Alcohol controls my life, what I do and who I do it with, where I live and where I go. Alcohol controls my life. I have no choices. That was the powerlessness and the unmanageability for me. My son was 11 months old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I am having one of the most major hot flashes I have ever. I know a lot of you know this. No booze is bad enough, but no booze and no estrogen's a killer. Hey, I start undressing now. Who knows? My son was 11 months old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I brought him with me because I didn't know what to do with him. I didn't know, I absolutely no idea what to do with him. So I'd bring him to meetings, and one of you would take him, and you'd hold him for an hour and a half, and you'd love him. And I'd bring him to another meeting, and somebody else would take him for an hour and a half, and somebody else, and somebody else. And my son was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. You taught him how to love. He learned how to be a human being from you, and I'm grateful for that. And my son, he's grown up here with you, and when he was a teenager, I started getting phone calls and this from school, and his grades were slipping. And I'm telling the vice principal that, you know, he's just one of those kids who education's not important. It'll probably be important for him when he's in his early 20s. And I start having people tell me that they think he's using marijuana. And I'm saying he can't possibly. You know, he's raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's got these big old bags under his eyes that are about to his knees. My roommate found a bag of marijuana in his room. I don't know what she was doing in there, but she brought it out and showed it to me. And out of my mouth, I say, well, it probably belongs to one of his friends. Rationalization, justification, and denial. And I'm in the ring with alcohol, and I'm going to lose because I'm making up excuses and reasons and justifying for my son, and I'm in the ring. And I'm a single parent. I've always been a single parent. It's my son and I. It's always been my son and I. One Friday night he came home, and God will do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. God won't do for me what I can do for myself, like send me a pile of money in the mail. It's not going to happen because I have the ability to go to work, but God will do for me what I can't or won't do for myself. Because my son came in one Friday night about midnight, and he wasn't quite 18 years old yet, and I stood up and looked at him, and out of my mouth came these words that I would never have spoken to my son. Out of my mouth comes the question, are you loaded? God will do for me what I cannot do for myself. I would have never asked my son that question. And he had heard me for so long that didn't even skip a beat. He justified, rationalized, and denied. He said, no, I'm just tired. And out of my mouth, I said, if you're tired, you need to come home earlier. And you need to make a choice. You can either smoke marijuana or you can live in my house, but you can't do both. I would have never said that to my son. My son walked into his bedroom, and about 10 minutes later, he came out with the backpack over his shoulder, and he had made a choice. Intellectually, I understand that choice. I have made that choice over and over and over. If it came between it and a drink, I took a drink. If it came between a job and a drink, I took a drink. If it came between a person and a drink, I took a drink. If it came between anything and a drink, I took a drink. The only thing I wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer. I had an opportunity to go into that profession. I gave it up for one more drink. Whatever it is, I gave it up for another drink. Intellectually, I understand the choice. But when your child makes that choice, it affects you at a completely different level than intellectual. And my son had made the choice, and he walked out of my house. And I have been in pain in my life, and I'll probably be in pain again. But I have never, except for the pain of not drinking and not recovering, I have never been in the pain that I was in when my son made that choice. I was a little over 16 years sober, and I didn't know what to do. I did not know what to do with that pain. I sat on my couch and I was thinking, I can either kill myself or I can drink. And I couldn't decide which one to do, kill myself or drink. They were my only solutions. Sometimes my solutions are worse than the problem, but this is what I'm thinking, kill myself or drink. And I can't decide what to do. And they say, you know, that don't think, don't think, don't think. I want to encourage you to think. Thinking has never gotten me into trouble. Taking an action will get me into trouble. But thinking about it has never gotten me into trouble. And I sat on my couch and thought, drink or kill myself, drink or kill myself. For 2 days, I'm on my couch. I cannot decide what to do. And then the phone rang. And it was one of the women I sponsor, and they never call you up and start the conversation with, how are you? I answered the phone. It was one of the women I sponsor, and she started flattering away about him, and he did this, and he did that. And when she finally took a breath and I could get a word in, I said, okay, wait a minute. If we leave right now, we can meet at the Canyon Club for the 12:30 meeting. I'll meet you there, and then we'll talk about him. And I hung up the phone. And I went to the Canyon Club to meet her, and we went to the meeting, and after the meeting, we talked about him, and I shared my experience, strength, and hope, and she left. And you know that horrible pain I'd been in just a few hours before? That pain was not gone by any means. But the pain had diminished just a little bit. And every time I took another right action after that, the pain went a little less and a little less and a little less. Until finally the pain of that experience, I still have some of that pain. I think as a human being and as a mother, I will always have some of that pain. But that pain went away because I took right actions and my focus was on what is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? And that's what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Whenever I take a series of right actions, whatever my problem is, God seems to be able to take care of it. God can't do a thing with it when I'm holding on to it, when I'm focused on it, when I've got this issue and I've got to fix this problem and I can't come to the meeting tonight because I got this issue and this problem to take care of and I'm sorry, you'll have to call somebody else to take you to the meeting and I can't give you a ride and no, I can't show up there because I've got this problem. God can do nothing with the problem. When my attention goes to you, and what is it I can do for you, and how can I be of service? When my attention's on you, God comes in and takes care of the problem, and God has done a wonderful job with the relationship with my son and I. My son and I have a completely different relationship than we've ever had before. He never moved back home. He did live in his van in my driveway for a while, but he never moved back home, and as of yet, he has not chosen to give up marijuana, but he knows where the solution is when he needs it because he was raised with you. He knows where to come when he needs to be here. And I have learned through this experience that God has no grandchildren. We are all God's kids. And God has a plan for my son, the same as he has a plan for me. And more than that, I know he has a plan for my son that is bigger than anything that I could think of for my son. Bigger than anything I could imagine for him, God has a plan for him. So I leave him in God's care. Doesn't mean I don't worry about him. Does not mean I don't enable him. And does not mean I'm not forever non-codependent. I am still a mother and he is still my child. But I leave him to God and to God's plan. And there is no way to get from there to there from where I was on October 14th, 1975, except through the power and the magic of the 12 steps of recovery. There is no way to get there because I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the way the book says. Selfish and self-centered. What about me? What about me? What about me? I heard you say ridiculous things. You said it's the first drink that gets you drunk. I thought, well, if I could only drink one drink and I was drunk, I would probably want to quit too. I don't understand. I'm a good drinker. I drink from the time I come to until the time I pass out. I'm a drinking all day long. I don't understand. It's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I began the journey of recovery after 8.5 months when I took the first step. I wish I could tell you that I looked at the rest of the steps. I knew they were the solution to the problem in my life. I worked them all in 1.5 minutes and skyrocketed to recovery. But the truth for me is that I have never worked one of the steps until my back was against the wall. The pain was so great it was do it or die and I had no other choice. Under those circumstances, I become very willing to look at the next one of the 12 steps of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in working the steps, the principles have been applied to my life. I don't know about applying principles to my life. I am unprincipled, I'm undisciplined, and I'm selfish and self-centered. But somehow through taking the action of the steps, I have been restored to right thinking. Somehow through taking the action, the steps, I have started to become the person that I believe God intended for me to be. Somehow through taking the action, the steps, I have become accountable. I have become responsible. I have become reliable. I have become a human being. I think all the time, I should probably tell you this. You know, sometimes in California, we tell newcomers, don't think. I don't know how you do that. I think all the time. I'm talking to you. I'm thinking about something else. Then I start thinking I shouldn't be thinking what I'm thinking while I'm thinking what I'm thinking. Then I try not to think what I'm thinking while I'm thinking what I'm thinking that I shouldn't be thinking. I'll tell you what I'm grateful for. I'm grateful I don't have a loudspeaker on my head so that everything I thought came barreling out. I mean, I'm really grateful for that. But I think all the time. And all of my life, I tried to think my way into right living. That never worked for me. As a result of taking the action of the steps, I have been able to act my way into right thinking. The book Alcoholics Anonymous does not have a chapter into thinking. It does not have a chapter into feeling. It seems to me the chapter is into action. It's an action program. It's about taking actions. The first action I took was the fourth step. I wrote the inventory. I was in the workshop today about the fifth step, and somebody shared something that made me think. I loved the fourth step when I finally got to it. I resisted it. I didn't want to do it. I thought it was for those of you who had no creative writing skills. I mean, I had a lot of reasons not to do it, and I didn't do it until I did it. And when I did it, I was so excited about it because this is what it wanted to know. Everybody you resent, well, almost everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine got on that list. Next column, what they did to me. I've wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. Third column, how it affected me. And I was really having a good time. I was really sorry I waited as long as I did, and except then in my zealousness, I accidentally turned the page of the big book. And 2 pages after it shows that diagram, Diane, cover your ears so you don't hear this. Hidden in the body of the text, it says, referring to our list again. We put out of our minds the wrongs others had done, and we looked at our part. Well, that wasn't any fun, but I'd have been having a great time up until then. And I did that with my resentments, my fears, and my relationships. And it seems to me, and again, this is just my perspective, it seems to me that people hurt me all my life. It seems to me people let me down and they disappointed me. I grew up knowing that if I couldn't do something, it didn't need to get done. I didn't need you or they or them. Nobody was going to be there for me anyway. You told me you would, and you weren't. So as a small child, I had begun to build this big brick wall to keep you out. And I built this big brick wall, and it kept you out. What I never knew about that wall is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out from behind that wall. Alcohol just made it okay for me to be behind the wall. And when I did my fifth step, that big brick wall I had between me and you, that wall didn't fall down. When I did my fifth step, one brick came out of that wall. But every time I've shared with another human being, another brick has come out of that wall. Until tonight, I have no brick wall between me and you. I have a little styrofoam thing I throw up sometimes, but... And the reason for that is this. I thought, now nobody told me this, this is one of my thoughts that I have without any input from anybody. I thought that if I worked the steps hard enough with enough passion, with enough zealousness, if I really worked the steps, that somehow I would skyrocket above humanness. I would, I would somehow be up here. I would never experience a feeling that I judged as negative. Would just never be afraid. I hear people say that. If you have faith, you can't have fear. I think that's poop. I have a tremendous amount of faith. But as a human being, I sometimes have fear. And what I learned through working the steps is I came into my humanness. And as a human being, I have fear. I have inadequacy. I have self-doubt. I have everything that we have as human beings. The difference today when I have one of those feelings is I have you. And you take my hand and you walk with me and we walk through it. I used to stop and have a drink, and then I'd have to have another drink and another drink and another drink, and I have no choices. Today I have you to walk with me through those feelings. As a result of working the steps, this amazing thing has happened to me. And I think this is the miracle. I'm going to share the miracle with you, because sometimes we don't. We tell people don't leave before the miracle happens, and then we don't tell them what it is. The miracle for me is step 6 and 7. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about in step 7 about walking through the archway to freedom. And when I took step 7, I walked away from the person I've been all of my life. The best I've ever described myself when I came here as an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result of step 7, I walked away from that person. As a result of you sharing your life with me, you taught me how to live. You taught me how to be a mother, a daughter, a sister, an employee. Everything I know, I learned from you. And as I learn from you, I start to become the person God intended for me to be. And tonight I can tell you I'm very kind, I'm very gentle, I'm very loving, I'm very caring. Of course, they tell me it's codependency and I have to recover from it. But I love the person who I am. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. Steps 8 and 9 for me are conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things for a lot of people for one more drink. I hear people ask, you know, well, should I put myself on the list? Well, when I make my list, should I put myself on the top of the list? I'm going to tell you something about me. If I put myself on the top of the list, I will never get to number 2. I will be so busy making amends to myself, I will never get to number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I suppose if I belong on the list, I belong on the bottom. Because as a result of making the amends to you, I made the amends to me. As a result of making amends to you, I got right with me. And in getting right with me, I got right with God. And 10, 11, and 12 are the recovery steps. They're the steps that allow me to continue to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look at them this way. I look at them like going to the maid company. I go to the maid company, I walk in on the first floor, but I want to go to the second floor. And I'm basically pretty lazy, so I go immediately to the escalator. I always go to the escalator that's coming down. Now, you can get from the first floor to the second floor on the down escalator, but you got to keep moving. And that's what 10, 11, and 12 are. They keep me moving up the down escalator. If I stop using them, I don't hit bottom right away, but I start going down. So 10, 11, and 12 keep me moving up the down escalator. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it, ask God to remove the defect, make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? Step 11 for me, I'm a simple person. My prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. And I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job is to not drink, show up, and live life to the fullest. My prayer at night is a little scarier, and I offer it to you. My prayer at night is, dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. When I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will keep me responsible and accountable. It will keep me when I'm driving down the freeway and some bozo cuts me off. I don't have to speed around and flip him off and pull in front of him. And I don't not do that out of virtue. I do that because I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight. When I'm in line at the 10 item or less counter, I don't have to count the items of the person in front of me and think, oh, he's got 14, that lousy, no good. And I don't have to get up to the checkout woman and give her a ration of shit because she let this yo-yo come through with 14. And I don't not say it because I'm such a wonderful person. I don't not say it because I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight. Please, God, have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today, and it will hold me in good stead. The greatest gift you've ever given me is the 12th step. The opportunity to take a little of my past, a little of the incomprehensible demoralization, a little of the despair, and to share it with another human being and say, honey, you don't have to live that way anymore. Take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't have to live that way anymore a day at a time. I need to tell you I have done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've slept with newcomers. I'd do it again in a minute if I had an opportunity. Unfortunately, the path gets narrower. I'm judgmental. I love gossip. I can hardly wait to get out of a meeting to tell somebody who was there with who. I've charged a woman for a 12-step call one time. I was at a meeting. I was at my mother's house, and I go to meetings when I go to my mother's house. My mother passed away a couple of years ago, and as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, and as a result of you teaching me that the amends were more than saying sorry, as a result of you sharing with me were that the amends were about living my life differently, and because you shared with me how to be a daughter, I had an opportunity to make amends to my mother and get right with my mother before she passed away. And I'll tell you what, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I came here to stay out of jail. And if I'd ever had it my way, a single day in the last 24 years, I'd have shortchanged myself. But I got right with my mother because you taught me the amends were about more than just saying sorry. But when I would go visit my mother, I'd go to meetings, and I was at my mother's one Sunday, and I got a phone call from a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had gotten a 12-step call from a woman who had been in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this woman had called one more time. And this woman had gotten the call, and she called everybody she knew, and either they weren't home or they wouldn't go. I've been there before. I'm not going. They either weren't home or they wouldn't go. And she called me, and I went with her on this 12-step call. And we got out, and I'll tell you, if money could keep you sober, this woman had never had a problem. Her driveway was at least a quarter of a mile long. We finally got up to the house. She had this big oak door about 2 feet, and they are very expensive. I'm like clicking it off as I'm going up to the house. We went in, and the woman came down this spiral staircase in a nightgown with puke and wine on it, kind of like that old, I think it was Gail Garnett, Raleigh Hills commercial. She comes weaving down there. I sent the other woman into the kitchen to make coffee, and I looked at the drunk, and I said, honey, I know why you can't stay sober, and it's not your fault. You can't stay sober because the people in this town won't tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I live in another county, so I can't just give you the secret, but for $100, I should ask for more because she pulled $100 out of her pocket without missing a beat and handed it to me, and I put it in my pocket, and I looked her in the eye. I said, the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous is if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And this other lady came out of the kitchen. I said, we don't have to be here anymore, and we left. And when that woman took a cake for 1 year of sobriety, I gave her back, well, you can give her back her $100, but I gave her back $100. And never once in that year did she ever tell anybody I charged her for that 12-step call. And she's 18 years sober, a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Very active in H&I work, very active in work in hospitals and institutions and in the prisons. I haven't charged anybody since, but I have done everything wrong here, and the only thing I've done right is I haven't taken a drink. And if I don't take a drink today, if I don't like the way I behave today, if I don't like the way I live today, if I don't like the things I did today, if I don't take a drink, I have a chance to do it different tomorrow. If I don't like the way I live today, if I take a drink, I have no chance. I have to continue to live that way day after day after day. So no matter what it is, if I don't take a drink, I have a chance to do it differently. I have a chance to do it differently. I have a chance to do it differently. I'm going to end with a story that puts it all together for me. It's the story of the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. And St. Peter takes him to room and says, it says hell on the door. But when they open the door, it's a giant room and it's a giant banquet. Tables and tables and tables of food. Any kind of food you could ever imagine, as much food as you'd ever want. And the people in that room with all that food are hungry and they're starving and they're dying. And the reason that they're hungry is they have these long wooden spoons tied to their hand and the spoons are just a little bit too long and they can't quite get the food to their mouth. And so they're sitting amongst plenty and they're dying. And that's how I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty and I was dying. And they took him to a room marked heaven, and in that room was the same scene. Tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. And the people in that room had those spoons tied to their hands too, and the spoons were just a little bit too long and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth, but the people in that room were full and they were happy and they were content. And the difference was that one man was taking a spoonful of food and he was feeding the woman across the table and she was feeding the person next to him and she was feeding somebody else. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. No answers. I have to come here and I have to let you feed me. And if I'm lucky, every once in a while, I get to give a spoonful of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to another human being. And you don't have to have 10 years or 5 years or one year. If you've got one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman walking through the door. If you've got one day, you have something to give to the person next to you. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have it. I come here, and at the end of the meeting, when we say the Lord's Prayer, the person on my right is going to give me a little courage. And the person on my left is going to give me a little strength. And you're going to give me the courage and strength that I need to continue to choose to recover. And if you've got one day, give the person on your right a little courage and give the person on your left a little strength. We can do what I can't. I absolutely cannot go a day without a drink. But I come here and the magic happens. And we can do what I can't. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. If I didn't get drunk, my life would get different, and he didn't lie to me. And the thing I end with, I always end with it because it's been my experience, and I pray, God, it's your experience. And it's a line in chapter 5 that we already heard read tonight. It's a line that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.